Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel for the 3 o'clock docket is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dauphineau. And you are the case we have set for the 3 o'clock docket. You're the whole show. So I understand everybody's ready. So if you'll call the case, we'll get started. Mark?
Judge, before we start, can we ask the lawyers if they've got anything else they'd like to file before we start? We've just had a few things filed here the last couple of days. I thought maybe y'all had something else you want. Okay. I do appreciate all the briefing you've done. It's been very thorough.
Kept us out of trouble.
Didn't mean to spring something on you last minute. If it pleases the court, Your Honor, Mark Sutterth on behalf of the appellant Michelle Rodriguez. There's three main issues on this appeal. First is whether the limits under the Tort Claims Act and the Transportation Code apply on a per defendant basis or collectively to all defendants. Secondly, whether the dismissal of the driver under the election of remedies provision was improper. And third, whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying attorney's fees. First, and I'll obviously take questions at any point, but if not, with regard to the liability caps issue, as the court knows, governmental entities are immune under governmental immunity. The Tort Claims Act waives that to a limited degree. It has no effect on individual liability under the Tort Claims Act. The issue for individuals is official immunity, which was not at issue in this case. The statute, 101.021, specifically uses the articles A and the. It talks about a governmental unit is liable in certain types of cases. Liability of the state is limited to $250 per person. Liability of a unit of local government is limited to $100,000 per person. And that's what we're talking about in this case, a unit of government. Each unit has its own limit. A couple of cases have specifically recognized that. I don't find any case where anyone's ever made the argument that appellees make in this case that they do apply collectively. That's just never been addressed as the specific issue that I can find. They certainly haven't cited a single case that suggested that would be the rule. The Texas Supreme Court in 2000, in the case I eventually found and filed last night, TxDOT versus Able, was a suit against the Houston Metro Transit Authority and also the state of Texas, so we had two entities. The jury found that the state was not negligent. Only the Metro Transit Authority was negligent, but the state was liable for being involved. They were vicariously liable because it was involved in a joint enterprise with the authority. And the Supreme Court specifically affirmed a $200,000 judgment against Metro, which it said was the maximum amount under the Tort Claims Act because there were two injured people, and $500,000 against the state, which it said was the statutory maximum. And there was only one act of negligence, a single act, a single function. And in this court, many years ago in 89, in Tarrant County Water Control and Improvement District versus Crossland, similarly approved and discussed how it would have been proper to hold the Tarrant County Water District liable for $79,800, since it was 20% responsible for $399,000 of damages, the jury found. And also to hold the state of Texas liable to its maximum cap of $100,000 in the same case. Now, they did say that with the state being capped, you don't take that money and add it on to Tarrant County's cap, since Tarrant County was paying exactly what they were found liable for. But together, that was $179,800, even though the cap on one entity would have been $100,000. And again, there's not a single case, there's not even a law review article cited by appellees that suggests that the cap would apply collectively. In fact, the statute, the Transportation Code, which says that a contractor of a transportation authority is liable for damages only to the extent that the authority would be. Well, if they shared the cap, they wouldn't be liable to the extent of the authority. They'd be liable for less. In the trial court, they cited, their main case they relied on was City of Austin versus Cooksey, which is conspicuously absent from their appellate brief. That case held that when you've got multiple wrongful death beneficiaries, those are derivative claims, there's one cap per one defendant. But it didn't say anything about the cap applying to multiple defendants, and it specifically said in dicta that not only did they cap out against the governmental defendant in that case, but they could have also gotten money from the City of Austin under a separate cap if they had just sent them the statutory notice, which they forgot to do. So there's just really no argument, I don't think, a valid argument that the caps apply collectively to all the defendants under one cap. The next main issue is the dismissal of the bus driver. The bus driver, Vaughn, in her pleadings and in her motion for summary judgment, pled that she was entitled to dismissal under the election of remedies provision of the Tort Claims Act. And the court specifically granted summary judgment on that basis. Now, for the very first time, when they filed their brief on appeal in this case, the appellees have come up with a new argument, they say, which was not pled, was not part of their motion, and was not part of the court's order. They say she's actually an independent contractor because she's the employee of an independent contractor. No case has ever said that. They cite three cases for that. They cite three Texas Supreme Court cases, Mobile Oil Corp versus Ellender, Fort Worth Elevators versus Russell, and this Houston case, Ardoin versus Anheuser-Busch. None of those cases had anything to do with the contractor whatsoever. Those cases talk about when a corporation is responsible for punitive damages. They say a corporation can only act through its agents and employees, but not everything an agent or employee does is done by the corporation. Only an act done by a vice principal is what those cases say. Nobody's claiming that this bus driver is a vice principal. It's just a non-argument. It's not any support for the argument that the bus driver herself is somehow an independent contractor. And I'll cite to the record in her plea, in the motion for summary judgment, they specifically, Vaughn and the other defendants specifically said, quote, Fort Worth Transportation contracted with two independent contractors, MTI and MTA. That's it. Record 232, clerk's record. In the pleadings, it's also at, it's also in the motion for summary judgment. And the court's summary judgment was specifically, court's record 396, said plaintiff's claims against Bond are dismissed based on plaintiff's election of remedies, not because she was a contractor. But even assuming they had raised it, I'll just, for the sake of argument, tell you, they didn't put on any evidence of that. The evidence was a contract to which she's not a party. MTA, MTI, and Fort Worth Transportation are the only contracting parties. What she was granted summary judgment on was election of remedies. This was clearly erroneous and requires reversal under the de novo standard. The election of remedies provision applies only to, quote, employees of a governmental unit, 101.106 of the Tort Claims Act. It lists employee six times. Every time it specifically says employee of a governmental unit. If there were any question, section 101.0012 of the Tort Claims Act specifically defines employee and specifically states employee, quote, does not include an independent contractor or an agent or employee of an independent contractor. So whether Vaughn was actually an independent contractor herself or was the employee of an independent contractor, she is not entitled to be dismissed under the election of remedies provision. There's a case directly on point that we've discussed in the brief, Castro versus Camarino out of Dallas. It was a petition denied case from 2006. Which specifically held bus driver employed by a regional transportation authority is not barred by the election of remedies provision since she's not an employee of the government. And that's just exactly right. There's nothing that holds to the contrary. They cited three cases to try to argue the contrary, Franca versus Velasquez, Klein versus Hernandez, and Rice University versus Rafe. And Franca and Velasquez both specifically held that we've got a statute which says the resident of a state-supported medical school is an employee of a state agency for purposes of liability, then sure enough, she is an employee of a state agency for purposes of liability. That's not controversial. Rice versus Rafe said that a commissioned Texas peace officer is an officer of the state, not because of who he works for, but because the state statute specifically vests him with all the powers, privileges, and immunities of a peace officer. So these cases hold that if a statute says you're an officer or a statute says you're an employee for liability purposes, you are. The Texas Transportation Code does not say anything about the employee of a contractor of a transportation authority. It does not say the employee is an employee of the state or anything like that. More importantly, the Tort Claims Act specifically says they are not. So it's also just important to note at this point, I think, that even the employee of a government is not entitled to damage caps under the Tort Claims Act. Assuming for the sake of argument that Vaughn should be considered an employee of a governmental unit for liability purposes, that doesn't mean her damages are limited under the Act. The Tort Claims Act doesn't cap individual liability of state employees. The three cases they cited, Franca, Klein, and Rafe, don't concern the Tort Claims Act. They don't concern liability. They concern official immunity and interlocutory appeals. The potential defense for a government employee is official immunity. It's an affirmative defense which was never pled in this case. It was never raised in this case. It's not part of the summary judgment in this case. And it really couldn't be because we're talking about a bus driver in a non-emergency situation, and you're not an employee of a government is not entitled to official immunity for negligent operation of a motor vehicle in a non-emergency situation. I assume that's why they didn't raise even that defense. But the individual liability of employees under the government is not capped by the Tort Claims Act. The trial court couldn't have dismissed plaintiff's claims on that theory that they fell under the same shared cap as the Fort Worth Transportation Authority. And that's not what the court did. The court dismissed her specifically under election of remedies, which the Tort Claims Act specifically says doesn't apply to the employee of a contractor, which the evidence undisputedly shows that she was. Very briefly, and I'm not going to talk about this much at all unless you want me to, there's six reasons, and we discuss them in our brief, why the court should be affirmed in denying the attorney's fees on the interpleader action that they filed. First, only innocent disinterested stakeholders can recover fees for interpleader, not tortfeasors, not the parties that are actively seeking and opposing declaratory judgment on all these other issues. Second, they didn't unconditionally tender the money. As our citation showed, they said we're tendering this only if you accept our arguments. Third, they weren't exposed to double or multiple inconsistent liability. Any claim against any one of these defendants is under a cap. It's going to be a derivative claim. They're only going to be responsible for their capped amount. There was never a dispute between the two plaintiffs in the case as to how that money would be split, or saying I'm entitled to it, not him. He's saying there's no evidence of any dispute. There's no evidence of one scrap of work these attorneys did with regard to any dispute that we had, because we never had a dispute. MTI voluntarily intervened as a defendant and is therefore responsible for any competing claims that were actually against it. They voluntarily intervened as a defendant a year after the statute of limitations had run, months and months and months after these competing claims had been filed. And that brings up the fifth reason: an unreasonable delay in filing a petition for interpleader is one ground a court can deny it. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Any questions?
I'll save what I need to ask him about whenever he rebuts.
Okay, thank you. Tim?
May it please the court. My name is Tim Chivonik. and together with Mark Creighton, I represent the defendants in this appeal. Our argument today is fourfold. First, the election of remedies under the Tort Claims Act required dismissal of the bus driver below. And there are two recent Texas Supreme Court opinions which persuasively support that dismissal. Second, a single $100,000 tort claims cap applies to this single wrongful death case as it applies to the T's liability and the liability of their two statutorily protected independent contractors. Third, the election of remedies provision of the Tort Claims Act as applied in this case is not unconstitutional, as argued by the appellant. And fourth, time allowing, will address the attorney fees issues and our limited appeal cross point concerning the court's denial, complete denial of our attorney's fees both at trial and on appeal pertaining to the successful interpleader declaratory judgment action. Turning to the first issue, the election of remedies provision. Let's reset the argument that you just heard. Ms. Vaughn is a private employee of a private contractor. Therefore, she can never obtain relief under the Tort Claims Act election of remedies provisions. 18 days ago, the Texas Supreme Court issued a pair of decisions that speak volumes to that argument. The Raffaele case involved Rice University. The Brown and Gay case versus Olivares involved an engineering firm. Let's talk about Raffaele first. Raffaele involved a private security officer employed by a private university. Claimed official immunity at trial was denied, tried to interlocutorily appeal that denial, was denied, went to the Texas Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, wait a minute, that private employee has standing, let's remand that case for the Court of Appeals to review their argument of immunity. And in doing so, they construed a 2010 decision, Klein versus Hernandez. And the court tells us what Klein meant for the first time, which is why it's so significant. The court said in that per curiam opinion, we begin our analysis with Klein. In Klein, a statutory scheme enabled a private university to qualify as a state agency, and therefore its employee, the defendant doctor, qualified as an employee of a state agency for the purpose of determining his liability and indemnity under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Private employee, private employer, wait a minute, protection, potential protection under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code.
Because of a statutory scheme, what's the statutory scheme in this case?
Your Honor, in that case, it was the Education Code. In our case, it's the Transportation Code. And that brings us to the second opinion. Brown and Gay versus Olivares, a tragic wrong way vehicular accident where a drunk driver went and entered an exit, killing some folks. They sued Brown and Gay. Brown and Gay said, wait a minute, we were working for the Fort Bend County Parkway Authority. Therefore, we're entitled to immunity. The court denied that argument, but in denying it, our Justice Lehrman wrote the majority opinion, and she talked about what the Olivares were contending to defeat that argument of Brown and Gay. And she said, the Olivares contend, and this is at page 7 of the slip opinion, Olivares contend that affirmative statutory extensions of immunity to private contractors in some instances demonstrate legislative intent. For example, she goes on to say, the Transportation Code provides that an independent contractor of a regional transportation authority that performs a function of the authority or certain other specified entities is liable for damages only to the extent the authority or entity would be liable for performing the function itself. citing Chapter 452, 056. That's what we've cited in our brief. The court also cited 452, 0561. We cited in our brief. What the court's saying in Brown and Gay is, Brown and Gay, you lose because you don't have a statute like 452.056. We have that statute. That's our argument. Even though Brown and Gay did not prevail because they did not have a similar statutory enactment. Rafaei did not prevail, at least with regard to the interlocutory appeal issue, because in that case, Officer Spears had a provision of the education code, which might very well grant him official immunity on remand. And if there were any doubt about all this, Chief Justice Hecht, we think, put the nail in the coffin with regard to this argument. On page one of his concurrence in Olivares, he said, an independent contractor may act as the government, in effect becoming the government, for limited purposes, and when it does, it should be entitled to the government's immunity. A statutory example is section 452.0561. That's our statute. Chief Justice Hecht is essentially saying that for the purposes of the Tort Claims Act, those independent contractors are governmental entities. In this instance,
but
MTA.
That's limited to the amount of recovery, and the issue here is election of remedies, and it's a distinction.
Your Honor, that's certainly not what Klein held.
Klein, well, how do we get around the definition in 101.0012 defining an employee not to include an independent contractor or agent or employee of an independent contractor?
Well, Your Honor, there's really nothing to get around. The concept of derivative governmental immunity means that if you don't meet the statutory definition per se as an employee of the government, derivatively you do. So you're not going to meet the definitional standard under the derivative governmental immunity.
But isn't your whole argument on this issue about doesn't this go to the dismissal of the driver argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're not talking about immunity. You're talking about election of remedies.
You are. The state has provided a remedy. It's against the governmental entity, not against the individual employee, as in Rafaei, as in Klein versus Hernandez, as in Franca versus Velasquez. All three of those cases involved an employee of a private company that was deemed to have the protections of the election of remedies provisions because there was an outside statute. Counsel's correct. The Health and Safety Code provided that outside statute in Franca and Klein. The Education Code ostensibly provides that protection in the Rafaei case, and the Texas Transportation Code provides LaShawn Vaughn with that very same protection under the election of remedies. In summary, a private employee of an independent contractor is entitled to the protections of the election of remedies provisions of the Tort Claims Act. And the trial court so held and properly dismissed LaShawn Vaughn from this case. Issue two, the Rodriguez cap, what we call it in the brief. Their argument in Crossland, they cited Crossland, they've cited Abel last night. Good for them. The fact of the matter is, this court held in Crossland that the state of Texas was held to a single cap, despite the fact that two of their sub-entities, the Parks and Recreation Department and the Department of Highways, had been sued separately. And the court said, no, they are constituent parts of a single entity, the state of Texas. Mr. Plaintiff, you're limited to a single limit, $100,000. That's it. A clearer statement of what happened in this case doesn't exist. Crossland disposes of that argument. No one is more surprised than the litigants that there isn't more law on this issue. But this is a statute protecting the government. Under the rules of the applicable rules of statutory construction, both in the government code and in the decisional law, require this statute to be evaluated under a very onerous standard from the plaintiff's perspective. It is required to be reviewed in favor of the state. State public interests predominate over private personal interests. And that brings us to the third argument, the constitutional argument, where this court, as recently as Lund versus Giacque, held that the election of remedies provision, that case involved an individual suit by a family in a tragic circumstance against some adoptive workers for the Family and Protective Services. And they argued in that case, hey, we're allowed to sue individuals, even if they work for the government, and recover for their negligence. In that case, apparently, they had missed some warning signs with regard to some adoptive children. They welcomed them into their home, and those children that they had adopted abused their own natural children. A tragic circumstance. And the court there, despite the tragedy, said, wait a minute. It's okay under the police power for the legislature to make decisions like this, to say, if you're going to sue somebody, sue the state. Don't sue these individuals. And the court said that was a proper exercise of the police power and not a violation of the open courts provision, as has been alleged. The trial judge did not violate the Constitution in this instance. With regard to attorney's fees, and the T made the determination early on in this litigation to tender its limit. The evidence is in the record that they tried to tender that limit early. All they wanted was some assurance that they weren't going to have to come out of pocket for other claimants. Then New Hampshire filed their lawsuit, the subrogation claim. And they were aware that suddenly you had a subrogation claim and you had a wrongful death claim. After both of those lawsuits were on file, settlement efforts continued in the record. Mr. Creighton testified in the attorney's fees portion of the case about these settlement efforts. There's also a lot of things in the record with the contested motions for consolidation, the contested interpleader. But the long story short is, when it became apparent that the two plaintiffs could not agree on how to split the limit, the T had no choice but to file an interpleader. And that interpleader cost money. Had they accepted it, we wouldn't be here today. They contested it at every level. Ably, counsel's able representation is noted. But all of that cost the interpleader, the innocent stakeholder, money. Take our money, please. No, we don't want your money. At every level. And that should require a court, under the decisions of this court, some attorney's fees. Now, should they have been segregated? Our argument is no, they weren't required to be segregated because both causes of action, both theories, allow for attorney's fees. So segregation wasn't required. Well, what about discovery? Well, there was no discovery. They never asked for the billing records. Why would any government entity's attorney enter their billing records as a matter of public record, unless you had to? There was ample testimony, ample opportunity to cross-examine. The appellate fees weren't even cross-examined. They were not even contested. And then the court entered a zero award for both. Respectfully, this court has the authority to find as a matter of law that those were reasonable and necessary, even if the court determined to pare down the amount of attorney's fees that were testified to with regard to the work at trial.
Mr. Chovanec, when you speak of the T as an interpleader, I read the record, it was the interpleader was MTI.
Your Honor, that's correct.
Are you equating MTI and the T as uniform whenever you say the T did the interpleading?
Your Honor, I see I'm out of time.
No, I'm asking that question. You can answer.
The Mr. Fundus sued the T, a.k.a. He sued FWTA, a.k.a. the T. Customarily, that is sufficient under the doctrine of misnomer to capture your independent contractors. There is no doubt that MTI is the operational entity that does most of the T's business. So when I use the term the T, I am using it loosely, and as you have identified. MTI filed the intervention because they were LaShawn Vaughn's employer and because they are the conduit through which the T conducts most of its business.
They filed the interpleader, you mean? You said
yes.
They filed the intervention. You meant
they intervened and interpled in the New Hampshire case.
I just want to be careful. I was hearing you right. You're equating the action of MTI to be the action of the T in filing the initial interpleader.
Yes, Your Honor. In essence, again, we're not stipulating that the two entities are identical for all purposes, but for the purposes of the interpleader, MTI was tendering that money on behalf of FWTA, MTI, MTA, and Vaughn.
Thank you, sir.
For these reasons, the defendants respectfully pray for an affirmance of the trial court's decision dismissing LaShawn Vaughn and capping the recovery in this case against all remaining defendants at $100,000, that this court enter an award of appropriate attorney's fees or in the alternative to remand on that very limited issue to the trial court for further findings in consonance with your direction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
John?
May it please the court. My name is John Fundus, and I represent Cross-Appalee New Hampshire Insurance Company. And it's only on the sole issue of whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in denying the request for attorney's fees that were filed by McDonald Transit, Fort Worth Transportation Authority, and LaShawn Renee Vaughn. One of the things to keep in mind on this is when you look at the cases, the award of attorney's fees on interpleaders is discretionary. The court has the opportunity to make that decision when they hear the evidence. In this case, the trial court heard the evidence and awarded no fees. One of the things I believe they looked at that the judge would have considered is whether or not these parties were truly disinterested, innocent stakeholders. When we look at the Brown versus Getty Oil case, it talks about that. And it says, in order to obtain fees on an interpleader, and that's filed under Rule 43, one cannot be responsible for the conflicting claims to the funds. But what does that mean? It means if you cause the problem that results in you having to plead money into the court to try to get out from underneath that problem, you can't then be rewarded with attorney's fees. That's what's happened in this case. There's no doubt in this case but that these parties are interested stakeholders. In fact, at the trial with regards to attorney's fees, there the attorney for the cross appellants himself, he admitted unquestionably they were interested in the outcome, and he stated that their clients were in the crosshairs of all plaintiffs. They were interested. They wanted to plead the money into the court and be finished. They were not innocent stakeholders. As a result, I believe that's sufficient to affirm the trial court's decision of the denial of attorney's fees. In addition to that, there was some discussion earlier about the segregation of attorney's fees in this case. While there may be an argument, segregation with regards to Michelle Rodriguez and whether it should or shouldn't have been done, I don't believe there is with regards to my client. There were two claims being lodged. There was an interpleader, and there was also a declaratory judgment action. The declaratory judgment action was never lodged against my client. We were never alleged to viable under that. We never had to defend against it, and it was never prosecuted as to us. As a result, if you're going to try to recover attorney's fees, you have to say, well, declaratory judgment fees, you can't get from my client. We can maybe get them from Michelle Rodriguez, but not from us. So they had to segregate those out. They would have needed to split that fees, split their time, show their tasks that were done for each one of those, so that they could then determine what fees are rightfully, if any, attributable to my client in this case.
Mr. Fundus, what was the amount of claim filed by your client, New Hampshire, dollar amount?
We filed a subrogation cause of action, which was really, I hate to say it, it's kind of free-flowing. As benefits continue to be paid, that amount changes. By the time of trial, we would have been well in excess of $100,000.
All right, thank you.
The other thing is the cross-appellants, they talk about the efforts of my client to thwart their claims for the interpleader. That's not the case. If you look at their brief, they cite 9 examples. They all go to Ms. Rodriguez and with regards to her prosecution of the claim. They don't cite to a single pleading or document that my client filed to contest the interpleader, to contest the consolidation, to contest the declaratory judgment action. We did nothing but sit there and wait for the money to be determined where it would go. Finally, when they looked at attorney's fees at the case, they did not present evidence of the specific time spent on each task. They just gave an overall number. They testified that they had in excess of $80,000 in attorney's fees, but they couldn't say for which task. When pressed on, and you'll see at the record, reporter's record on page 40, when pressed on, did you have a specific time as to my client? They testified, no, we don't know what was spent on those tasks. Because of that, I believe the Supreme Court's case of 2014 Long versus Griffin holds that that's insufficient evidence. As a result, there was no abuse of discretion. The trial court was proper in denying attorney's fees as to New Hampshire Insurance Company, and we would urge that you affirm that ruling. Thank you.
Can I ask you one more thing, Mr. Fundus?
Yes.
Not read in the record. I want to be careful that I'm remembering this correctly, but that your client ultimately resolved the issue of any claim with Ms. Rodriguez by the receipt of a $10,000 payment, and then you dismissed non-suit with prejudice.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mark?
I do want the court to realize, because it doesn't just jump right out of the record, but my client, Ms. Rodriguez, never got a penny of workers' comp benefits. The subrogation claim that his client was pursuing was for benefits that were paid to the decedent's mother. So we weren't both seeking the same money in any way. He said they tried to tender the limits. No, they tried to get us to agree that $100,000 covers everything. That's what the dispute was over. There was never a dispute on who gets what. The dispute was how big is the pie. And that's what all the litigation in this case has been over. None of it's been over an alleged dispute between us that required some interpleader. The statutory scheme under the election of remedies that they keep talking about, the cases they cite are statutes which specifically say this person is a governmental employee. It's not a statutory scheme that makes a private person a governmental employee. It's statutes that say you are an employee of the government for liability purposes. There's nothing like that in the transportation code. And in the Fort Worth Water Department case that this court considered, MCI and MCA are not the Fort Worth Transportation Authority. They're separate entities, just like Tarrant County Water Department and the state of Texas are separate entities, and therefore they both have their own cap. And I can talk more, but I know Justice Marty said you had a question.
I want you to talk about the Brown and Gay engineering case. You cited that and gave us a copy. How do you see that impacting your position in this case?
Not very much. I cited it in response to the argument that they had just raised in their letter brief, which was an argument that, oh, as the contractor of a governmental entity performing governmental functions, we ought to be immune just like the government is. That's really not what happened in the trial court, but that's an argument they made, citing this Rafi case, where the same day that Rafi came out, Brown and Gay came out and said, no, the fact that you are a contractor performing governmental functions that have been delegated to you and that the government has to approve and whatever, That does not make you share in the immunity.
Well, I understand that's the result of the Brown and Gay Engineering and Oliveri's case, but in that case, it specifically cites the statutes that are cited in this case in the Transportation Code for the proposition that treated the same means $100,000 cap.
That's exactly, and we don't dispute that whatsoever. The Texas Transportation Code essentially says that the contractor, it says you are not, the contractor is not a governmental entity for any purpose, except that it's liable only to the extent that the authority would be liable. And we don't dispute that MTA and MTI, the contractor, is liable only to the extent the authority would. What we're not going to do is make the leap to say, oh, that means their employees are immune. Because even the government's employees aren't immune.
So if you're conceding that they're to be treated the same in terms of what, to the extent of liability of the authority, I mean that the MTA, MTI are responsible only to the extent that the T's responsible, does that mean they're only responsible to the amount of $100,000?
Well, if $100,000 is the T's cap, and we had an argument, and is that not what you're asking?
Yes, that's what I'm asking.
We argued in this case that the T actually has statewide jurisdiction because they can enter contracts in other areas. We abandoned that as part of our summary judgment. The court hasn't actually had a chance to rule on that one way or another. I'm not very confident in that argument, and I'm not going to stand here and tell you that. I'm hoping I can develop that as the case hopefully proceeds. But whatever cap the T has, that's the same cap that would apply to MTA, $100,000. The same cap that would apply to MTI, $100,000. Three of them together, if they all are liable for some reason, it could be $300,000, even if the jury says $1 billion in damages.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We pray that the court be reversed, except for the attorney's fees part.
Thank you. Well, we appreciate your argument today. It's been very helpful. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.